It's Monday, November 21st, 2011. This is Ozarks at Large, and I'm Iti Agnihotri Mudholkar. Coming up on the show today, singer-songwriter Jay Nash from Los Angeles, who was in town earlier this fall for the Harvest Music Festival, talks to Kyle Kellums about his music. And retired journalist Ernie Dumas discusses a book he helped edit. Dearest Letty is a collection of love letters from a World War II soldier. The KUAF and Friends Holiday Giveaway will be held on Thursday, December 15th during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. This drawing is your chance to win a gift from one of many KUAF underwriters and program sponsors. Participants include Dog Party USA, Urban Jungle, Packrat Outdoor Center, and Ozark Natural Foods. Registration and more information are available on the web at KUAF.com. But first, last year, around this time, the Government Accountability Office tackled an audit of money, millions of dollars being disbursed to states and territories to help defray costs of certain Pacific Island migrants living in those jurisdictions. The audit was just released. Now some hope it will lead to millions of dollars coming to Arkansas to help defray education and healthcare costs for Marshallese moving here. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports.
Strapped by high unemployment, lack of medical care, and limited education opportunities, thousands of Palauans, Micronesians, and Marshallese are leaving their home islands in search of higher, more prosperous ground. Because of special treaties between the United States and those nations, their so-called freely associated migrants can travel to the U.S. for as long as they wish, with only a passport. But once here, they are not privy to entitlements such as Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, or even S-CHIP, even if they pay taxes. That's why under treaty compacts of free association, so-called compact impact funding, provides money to places where islanders are settling. Traditional recipient jurisdictions of that compact money are the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands, CNMI for short, Guam and Hawaii. But now, Pacific Islanders are moving to other destinations, including Springdale, Arkansas. So a year ago, the U.S. Government Accountability Office, pressed by stakeholders, initiated an audit to determine if compact impact funding ought to be distributed to more jurisdictions, like Arkansas.
My name is David Gutnick, G-O-O-T-N-I-C-K. I'm Director of International Affairs and Trade at the U.S. Government Accountability Office, GAO, and I'm the lead author of the study on compact migrants.
David Gutnick, who's conducted intense study of Pacific Islander migration, including spending time among the Marshallese in northwest Arkansas, said the audit was requested by a number of key leaders.
Right. So we were requested by a number of members of Congress, including the delegate from Guam, the delegate from CNMI, the entire Hawaii delegation, both senators and the congresspersons, as well as members of Congress from Arkansas, including your new senator, John Bozeman. We were asked to look at a number of facets of compact migration. We looked at the counts, and we got some new data on the numbers of migrants, of individuals from Micronesia, Marshall Islands, and Palau who have come to the United States under the Compact of Free Association. We looked at the ways in which the affected jurisdictions, this is Hawaii, Guam, and the CNMI, the ways in which they report the costs to their jurisdictions of providing for health, education, and other social services for compact migrants. And we looked at the grants that are administered by the Department of the Interior to Hawaii, Guam, and CNMI for purposes of defraying the costs of providing services. And lastly, at the request of your delegation, we did look at and make a case study from the migration of Marshallese to northwest Arkansas.
In order to direct new compact funding to Arkansas, it's necessary to have a clear count of Pacific Islanders living here. We have the new 2010 census figures and one other enumeration, but they clash.
Right. Well, you know, there are some important distinctions between the The numbers that were reported, numbers of Marshallese in, for example, Arkansas, that were reported in the 2010 census, and the number of Marshallese and Micronesians and Palauans who are reported in the various states, including Arkansas, under the American Community Survey, the data source that the U.S. Census Department used and we have presented, that looks at the number of migrants in the United States. Some important distinctions there, and the state of Arkansas did very much want to point to the distinctions there, because the 2010 census shows well over 4,000 Marshallese in Arkansas, whereas the American Community Survey, with a margin of error, only reports about 1,000 or 1,100 Marshallese in Northwest Arkansas. So an important distinction. The Department of Census is responsible for both of those statistics. They stand by both of those statistics and would indicate that they're not meant to be comparable. But the counts differ significantly depending on which of those two sources you look to.
Any census enumerator will likely miss any number of Marshallese living in Northwest Arkansas, given their cultural propensity to not discuss personal information with authorities. This study acknowledges that problem, looking toward the next Interior Department required count in 2013.
But there are some important distinctions between the total population of citizens of freely associated states who are in the United States and those individuals who are counted as compact migrants. So in order to count as a compact migrant, you need to have come here after the compacts of free association were established, and all of those individuals, as well as their U.S.-born children under age 18, are considered compact migrants.
First negotiated in 1986 and renewed in 2003 for 20 years, the Compact of Free Association conversely allows U.S. strategic military use of the Republic of the Marshall Islands, CNMI, and Palawan land. And while U.S. military installations provide some jobs to those islanders, the economy and those sovereign nations are floundering.
Right. So we found that the migration to the United States is growing, that there are now about 56,000 compact migrants in the United States. Citizens from the freely associated states, their first point of entry to the United States is typically Guam or Hawaii, but many of them are migrating well beyond there at this point, including Arkansas, but also California, Oregon, the state of Washington.
And demand for services in these additional states is growing. For example, a new public health clinic to serve Marshallese just opened in Springdale. Congress provided startup funds for it, but operating costs will be shouldered by the state.
Well, the affected jurisdictions cumulatively have reported about $1 billion in compact impact costs between 2004 and 2010 to provide services for compact migrants. So the largest cost center is educating the kids of compact migrants, but also health, social services, and public safety add up to about $185 million. Now, there is $30 million in compact impact grants that is allocated across those three jurisdictions on an annual basis. So all told, the reported impact costs exceed and do so by a considerable margin the amount that is available to defray those costs.
Among the recommendations, to better assess and account for just how compact impact grants are and will be spent, like any bureaucracy, there are cracks. So efficiencies and alternatives could help spread those dollars. Still, he said, Marshallese are here to work, so are contributing to the local economy. Copies of the report have been provided to members of Congress, Department of the Interior, the Department of State, the Census Bureau, and the governments of Guam, Hawaii, CNMI, Arkansas, Micronesian Federated States, the Marshall Islands, and Palau. Now, it will be up to policymakers to decide who gets what cut of the pie. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
To read the full report, visit gao.gov and browse November 14th reports. This is Ozarks at Large, and I'm Iti Agnihotri Madhulkar. The book, Dearest Letty, which was recently published by the University of Arkansas Press, is not just a collection of love letters. It's a travelogue as well as an extraordinary memoir of World War II soldier Sergeant Leland Duvall, who, despite being faced with harsh conditions, managed to profess his love and feelings for a girl he was smitten with. I asked the book's editor, retired journalist Ernie Dumas, about the process of working on Dearest Letty.
Well, this book is came about quite by accident. It is a compendium of love letters, or I guess starting off just letters, from a soldier who was going off to war in 1942. And decided to ask a girl for whom he'd had a secret infatuation back in the country in Pope County to see whether she would correspond with him. They'd never had a date or had very little contact with each other, maybe four or five times. And that exchange of letters occurred during the next 3.5 years while he was in training and at war in Europe during the European campaign of World War II. And of course, immediately after the war, 2 weeks after he came home in the September of 1945, or October, I guess it was 1945, they were married, and Leland died in 2006, and last year his widow, Letty, moved from Crow Mountain, which is a long mountain chain alongside Interstate 40 near Russellville, moved down to a retirement home in Russellville, and her daughter discovered these letters in an old rotting box in the garage and brought them to her, and that's how the book came about. Last spring, a woman who lived across the hall at the Wildflower Retirement Center from Letty Duvall heard her talking about these letters she was reading, and so she asked to read a few of them, and Letty consented, and it was her idea that these were a book, should be made into a book, and Letty protested, oh, no, Leland would never want people reading his letters. But they agreed that they should consult me about it. And, of course, I went up and looked at the letters, some of them, and told her I thought, indeed, that there was a superb book there and kind of arrested her fears about Leland. And she finally consented, and the University of Arkansas Press agreed to publish the book, and that's how it came about.
Did you know Leland?
Yes, I did. I knew him very well. We both worked at the Arkansas Gazette. We overlapped about 31 years, I guess. Leland went to work there in about 1955, and I came along 5 years later in 1960. And then the last 10 years before the Gazette closed in 1991, he and I worked together on the editorial page. We were both editorial writers for the Gazette.
Now, as a friend and a colleague, did you ever happen to discuss his time at the war with Leland?
Yes. At about 1998 or 1999, I was helping with a project of the University of Arkansas Oral History Division, and we were doing an oral history of the Arkansas Gazette, and in the course of it, we interviewed, four or five of us interviewed, 150 former employees of the Gazette, mainly writers and editors. And those are all, those interviews are all taped and are online, can be read at the University of Arkansas World History Project. And one of those was Leland. And so it was basically a discussion of his life, a long interview. I guess it constitutes maybe 100 or so pages, just a discussion of his life, mainly his newspaper career. But I did get him to talk a little bit about his experiences in World War II, and it was at that time that he talked a little bit about Letty. He described some of his experiences in those interviews back in 1998 or 1999, and in addition to his description of war in the letters, we do a little bit more of some of his more harrowing experiences during the war.
How did that knowledge, the knowledge of knowing Leland, help you with editing this book?
I think it heightened my enjoyment of working on it because I did know Leland very well and admired him so much. And so it was a great pleasure to edit him. And editing was actually a very easy job. All I did basically was cut them down because when I typed all the we copied all the letters, which were generally written out in pencil or ink on all kinds of pieces of paper, scrap paper, sacks, wrapping paper, stationery, whatever he could get his hands on. And we copied them, and I spent last fall typing them all in to the computer, and they came to 160,000 words. And Larry Malley, the University of Arkansas Press, said, "We can't publish a book of that magnitude. We don't think we could sell it. It would be too long." And he asked if I could cut the letters down to about 100,000 words. So that's basically what the editing that was required, a little of the kind of editing that you normally expect, going line by line and changing words and improving the sentence structure or grammar or whatever. None of that happened. I didn't really change a word of his. But I did cut out about 55,000 words, most of it just eliminating letters that I said, well, this is not as interesting as some of the others, or this is a little bit repetitive, or else there were long kind of dissertations about matters back home that readers might not be interested in. But he was quite a prolific letter writer. Not only did he write her these long, poignant, and often very beautiful letters, but he apparently had, I don't know, maybe 50 different people he corresponded with, including his mother up in Moreland and north of Russell. She had three sons in the war, all of them in Europe. One of them became a prisoner of war. And she apparently was quite depressed. And so he wrote her probably weekly from his descriptions to Letty. To try to keep her perked up, and all of his letters, I suspect, were like the letters to her, quite cheerful, except for some stages in the latter stages of the war when he seems to be kind of depressed himself. But generally his letters are kind of upbeat, which is quite amazing under such trying conditions as he was under during the, particularly once he reached the front in Europe.
And that is exactly what I found interesting, that it must have required some determination for Leland to write these letters when he was going through almost hell. And he's not just writing, he's also maintaining a sense of calm in his letters, which is
yes,
remarkable.
Yes, and I think that's part of that is just Leland. If you knew Leland Duval, calm was the one word you would use to describe him. He was... In the newspaper business, it gets quite frantic, deadlines every day. Leland was never frantic. The rest of us would all be panicky, but not Leland. He was always unflappable, and never excited, and always upbeat. And I think part of it also was that he did not want Letty or his mother or others to worry about him. And he obviously takes great pains to reassure them that things are going very well over here, and as if he's really kind of having a pretty good time of it. And then later you find out what he was enduring. And he actually also reassures from time to time, no, don't worry, I'm not going to try to be a hero. There are no heroes in this war, just people who are lucky and people who are unlucky. And I'm not going to make any effort to be a hero. You can be sure of that. So I'm not going to be any real danger. And, of course, when I found his separation papers, I discovered that he had been awarded 5 bronze stars for bravery. So he indeed was in a great deal of trouble quite often during the 1944 and 1945. That was just part of Leland. He never wanted anybody to be worried.
So as an editor, what do you primarily view this book as? It's a diary, a memoir, an expression of personal feelings, a description of the war, a travelogue, because there's a lot that goes on in this book.
Well, there is. It's several levels, as you say. One, it's sort of a memoir of the war from one person's standpoint. I think also it has some historical value, both nationally and in Arkansas. There's a lot of, you know, some Arkansas history in it as well. I think it has considerable literary value, particularly when you consider that this fellow was 31 years old when he gets his draft notice, and he had an eighth grade education, and could not have been a very strong education at that. It was eighth grade at a community called Moreland, which only had eight grades. You couldn't go to high school there. They had no high school. And the years were always very short because it was he was farm family, and so they had to work on the farm. So he had an eighth grade education, but he was self-taught. And until the war, he was basically an itinerant farm worker. That's all he did. He worked behind a mule and a plow. He was a strong-limbed fellow. And he worked in cotton gins in the Mississippi Delta and worked on farms behind a, you know, mule and a row binder, and followed the harvest and the planting out across the West Texas plains. And that's all he did until the war. And yet he was able to write so beautifully and so elegantly and so knowledgeably. He will be, say, in a pup tent someplace in Belgium, and it's cold and snowing, and he will begin to describe that, and it will remind him of a poem, and he starts reciting, obviously from memory, some poem, and I would look it up, and it would be a Shakespearean sonnet, and I would read the sonnet, and he would have it verbatim, except maybe for an article or two would be changed. But it's really quite remarkable from that standpoint. But as you say, it's a kind of a travelogue, both in the United States, some beautiful descriptions of the Mojave Desert and Southern California and the train rides across California and across the Sierra Nevadas and across the country to Tennessee and then up into New York to Lake Placid and down to New York City and then to England and then across France. So it's a beautiful travelogue as well. So it's a distinctive book on several levels.
Now, as an editor, did you ever think about the point that this might be one of the last such compilations of letters because nobody writes them anymore?
Well, that's true. Nobody writes letters. Everybody is texting or doing email now, and nobody takes great care in when they write emails, and they're usually killed out as well, so that we may not see anything like this again. And letter writing used to be a great art, and some of the great literature were letters back and forth between lovers, between friends and family members and so forth. But we may not see that again. This may be the last of those, unless further books or other troves of correspondence are discovered from that era.
Do you have a favorite letter that Leland wrote to Letty?
I probably five or six, I guess, letters that I guess toward the end of the war that are I think very poignant. Did you want me to read one or something?
Yes, if you could.
Well, let me see if I can. I got the book here, but I don't have anything pages marked. I can read you one or two that kind of gives you the humor and. And also, I guess, kind of the pathos of the letter. Let's see here. All right, this is very close to the end. The war in Europe is over. They're waiting in Germany to see whether he's going to ship out to Japan. And then shortly after that, they drop the bombs, and the war is over completely. And this is a letter written, this is part of a letter written from Heldra, Germany, on August 13, 1945. And again, this is kind of the last half of the letter. My dearest Letty, logically, in the long months we have been apart, we should have learned the knack of letting well enough alone, but I have never learned. Always when I go to bed, there is the same mischievous face, the same impish grin etched in the blackness of the ceiling. Always there is you. I cannot dismiss the face, nor do I want to. It says, take things easy, Junior. Sometimes it says toots, but it always means the same thing. There's really no need to be serious about all this that you see. The world is a place to laugh in and a thing to laugh at. There is war and suffering, like it says in the papers, but that is only a small part of the picture. There is the mountain where the wind is clean and sharp, and where the leaves play a soft symphony in the evening. There are quiet lakes where the grass has been nipped short by the grazing cattle so that it makes a carpet of green velvet. There are white birches for the shade, and thrushes and catbirds for the orchestra. Not all the world is tired and hungry and looking for some place to spend the night under a shed before moving out on a road that leads into the unknown. There is still the hometown, the face says to me, where you meet people who will call you by your first name and who really mean it when they shake hands with you. This is the part of the world that you grew up in. This is the kind of life that you learned to like, and it is the kind that you're going back to. I am marking a little corner of it reserved, and that is for us. I hold the other end of the rope that keeps you from drifting into the belief that all the people of the world are sordid, drifting herd of animals who have not made any progress in the thing we like to call civilization. All this, the face, that is, your face, says to me. Not in so many words, of course, for you would never be so verbose as all that. But you say it in the way you smile, and the way the smile makes me remember that it is all this is true. Love always, Leland. There are several letters like that about what she means to him, and that's particularly the last year and a half of the war. There are a lot of letters in which he kind of invokes her as kind of saving him. He's able to survive because of his expectations of a life with her afterward.
Ernie Dumas is the editor of the book Dearest Letty, The World War II Love Letters of Sergeant Leland Duvall. The book was recently published by the University of Arkansas Press. This is Ozarks at Large. The University of Arkansas is mourning the loss of Garrett Ekman, a 19-year-old student and athlete at the university. According to a UA Athletics Division news release, he was discovered in his dorm room unconscious and unresponsive late Sunday morning. Emergency medical responders failed to revive him. He was pronounced dead at Washington Regional Medical Center Sunday afternoon. UA police say the cause of death is not known and circumstances do not look suspicious. Ekman's body was sent to the state medical examiner for an autopsy. Garrett Ekman was a sophomore majoring in applied exercise science at the University of Arkansas. He was a redshirt freshman on the Arkansas Razorback football team and had played 9 games this season. The 19-year-old was from Little Rock and had graduated from Little Rock Catholic High School. Members of the Razorback football team were gathered early Sunday afternoon and informed of their teammate's death. Counselors were on hand to assist. In a personal statement issued by Garrett Ekman's parents, they described their son as living his dream, attending the U of A and playing football for the Razorbacks. KUAF is supported by Serta Pro Painters, serving residential and commercial clients with interior and exterior painting needs, including interior design, deck and fence staining, and specialty finishes. Locally owned and operated by Aaron Lewis. Estimates and information are available at 1-800-GO-SERTA or sertapropainters.com. It's Monday, November 21st, 2011. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Iti Agnihotri Madhokar, and with me is Becca Bacon-Martin, the features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
You know, there's this strange trend in movies, and I kind of like it, of recording live performances.
Yes.
And then presenting them in theaters. I missed Phantom of the Opera, which breaks my heart. Tonight at the Malco Razorback Cinema in Fayetteville, Lady Gaga presents the Monster Ball Tour from Madison Square Garden. It was filmed in February.
How much do the tickets cost?
$12.50. Lots less than if you went there.
Okay.
Or you can go see the UA Symphonic Band and Wind Symphony, both of which perform at 7:30 at the Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville, and tickets are $10.
That's a great option. Thanks, Becca. Becca Bacon-Martin is the features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
The first night in a desert city, yeah, you were tired. You still up at that motel. Girl thought he knew me. And you were waiting all night long to hear your name in one of my songs. We both knew it wasn't gonna happen. Now open my window, baby, tornado. Yeah, this house could explode.
That's Baby Tornado, performed by Jay Nash. Earlier this fall, the singer-songwriter performed at the Yonder Mountain Harvest Music Festival on Mulberry Mountain in Ozark. He stopped by our studio around that time to talk to Ozark's at largest Kyle Kellums about his music and collaborations with other artists.
Last year was definitely a busy year. There's actually a fourth project that's yet to come out that was kind of a songwriting collective where we had this songwriting retreat with a bunch of folks. Some of them you may have heard of, some may not. Amber Rubarth, Joey Ryan from the Milk Carton Kids, Vienna Tang, Adam Levy. Adam Levy, actually, if you're a Tracy Chapman fan, the top of the tune, Give Me One Reason, is Adam Levy. So it was kind of a really cool, talented group of characters, and we all got together in the beginning of 2010, and we spent a week writing songs and we recorded those. Now those songs haven't come out yet. Everything else has. So yeah, it was a busy year. And oddly enough, it didn't feel like a year where I was being wildly prolific. It was just a matter of kind of tidying up loose ends. All of those projects have been things that were the original seeds had been planted years before, and they kind of just came to fruition last year. And it was good because I was feeling like I was kind of closing up a chapter of my solo work of the music that I started on a record called The Things You Think You Need. And the kind of the second chapter of that is this record that came out this year called Diamonds and Blood. And I'd written a few songs for that, but it was really cool. Like co-writing, it can be a really great way to kind of break open the floodgates and kind of get into new sonic territory and get yourself out of, as an artist, I think sometimes you fall into, it's easy to fall into not a rut, but you get used to doing things comfortably. And when you get outside your comfort zone, interesting things happen.
I think those of us who aren't songwriters still get an idea of someone who is a songwriter. If you're writing a song by yourself, you imagine the songwriter with their instrument or a notepad, pen, an individual sort of task. When you collaborate, when you write a song with someone else, how does that work for you? What are the logistics?
Well, like writing a song on your own, where it can happen any different way. You know, sometimes you're sitting in traffic, you think of something. Before the advent of iPhones, I would leave myself messages with song ideas. I'd write it down on the back of a receipt, something like that. Co-writing is a little bit more organized, but it can take shape from, you know, it might stem from, hey, man, I got this melody. What is it?
And this is face-to-face?
Yeah, face-to-face.
You're in the same room.
So you might take a melody and I might show it to you and say, you know, does this inspire any kind of lyric in your mind, any kind of imagery? And or it might be the other way. It might be like, you know, I had this idea or this happened to me. And songwriting obviously is in the spirit of collaboration. And it's almost like you take two individual songwriters, and those two songwriters have two individual personalities. But a third personality typically emerges when two songwriters get together, and that's a cool thing. You know, it's not necessary. Occasionally, you're co-writing, well, I'm going to write for your voice, or you're going to help me write for my voice. But in my experience, it's almost like finding something new. And a lot of the writers that I've worked with last year are all fairly established and typically write most of their own material. It was kind of in the interest of finding, you know, new territory.
As you mentioned, the new CD is Diamonds and Blood. Mm-hmm. There's a song on there that I've been listening to over and over.
Oh, that makes me happy.
And that's River Prayer.
Oh, cool.
That is a gorgeous song.
Well, thank you so much. That's it's interesting that's the song that you gravitated to, because I think that's maybe one of the more obscure tracks. It definitely has a strong but maybe more diminutive legion of fans, that song. But I wrote that one actually a few years ago. I put on a concert in my hometown every year called Rock for the River. It's a benefit concert, and actually a guy from around here who grew up around here, a guy named Joe Purdy, he's been doing that concert with me since the very first one. But that song emerged. Actually, I wrote it. We usually gather up. There's usually 8 or 9 performers, and everybody stays at my folks' place up there in the Thousand Islands, just way up in northern New York. And everybody congregates a couple days before the concert, and we get together and we play music for a couple days and kind of put a show together. And I remember it was like 2 or 3 of my friends and musicians that were on their way in. They left New York City a little bit late, and they got stuck in the 4th of July traffic. So they were like not going to make it until like 7 o'clock in the morning. And like I was like kind of behaving like a den mother, just kind of waiting up for them. And as I was up all night waiting up for them, I just kind of wrote this little tune that's about this place where I grew up. And when I say I grew up, it's really where I really learned about love and life and death, and had some of my most powerful experiences there. And, you know, just have this constant of this, this body of water that almost seems to have a soul in and of itself.
You grew up there. You've lived in L.A. Now you're in Vermont.
Yeah.
Well, that's a boomerang there.
Yeah, when people ask me where I'm from now, I have to take a deep breath. I grew up in upstate New York, and I went to college in Vermont, and so I did spend some time there and get attached to it. And then I went, I graduated from school, and I went down to New York for a year and kind of got things, my music career kind of started in earnest there, and then got distracted by being a ski bum in Jackson Hole for a little bit. And then,
not the first.
Yeah. And then I ended up in L.A. I was with the intent of really just being there for a couple weeks, but stayed for 9 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I'm all over the place.
Whenever I see a list that you've put together of your influences, both people you know and people that other people might know, like Bob Dylan or mm-hmm. the Grateful Dead, one that doesn't show up, and I wonder if you're familiar with this artist, because Labor Day Blues, the mm-hmm. first time I heard it, reminded me of Peter Case.
Oh, yeah.
It was in the band The Plimsolls, and is a great singer-songwriter.
I need to dig deeper into his material, because I see his name on 50 to 80% of the venues that I play. Mm-hmm. And I know he's – I've heard from so many people that he's great. But there's so many great songwriters out there.
Oh, yeah.
So that's cool. I'll have to check him out.
Yeah, and that's a very high compliment. Thank you, Peter Case. Right. Your CDs, like Diamonds and Blood, are on your label. It's you.
Yeah.
You control everything.
That's the advantage is, you know, you get to make all the decisions. You don't have to kind of compromise your art to make whoever's bankrolling the project happy, which can be an incredibly frustrating and heartbreaking experience. The downside is that occasionally you have to ask questions like, oh, well, you have all these records. How come you're not more famous? And I read a great quote today. Bob Dylan said, he's like, you know, I've learned that privacy can be sold. But the thing is, you can never buy it back. Mm-hmm. And, there's great truth to that. And one of the major advantages is I can live in relative anonymity. You know, making the records that I want to make and having a career in music and feed my family without having to compromise all these things and without, instead of, you know, selling a million records and getting 1% of that, I'll sell 10,000 records and get 100% of that. And it works out to be a pretty similar income, you know. So it's just it's the way that I've kind of done it from the beginning, and every time I had an opportunity to compromise to maybe join forces with a greater entity, I kind of found it hard to compromise. So
right.
So
greater mean bigger.
When I say greater entity, I mean like a big like record label or
right.
So yeah, that's. That's my explanation.
I like it. Well, do you mind playing something?
Sure, yeah. I didn't arrive with a set list, but maybe I'll play that song, Labor Day Blues, because mentioned it. And that might be a good one for me to play, given that I've just stepped off an airplane and my vocal cords are probably all dried out.
My birthday came a day too late, as my old man could not cheat fate. He was wrapped in pride, never wanted to wait. But another night, another song, and pour me one. It's been too long. Let's stay, talk a while about the past. Ain't it just bittersweet how the river rolls? The services were short and sweet, beautiful, but incomplete. The faces in the crowd seemed so at peace. Oh, I didn't think I'd see her there. Didn't occur to me she would care. She was standing in the stained glass sun just crying. She's here today, but she'll be gone tomorrow. How the river rolls. I'm up all night writing songs, doing my best to get along. But sometimes you are safer when you're wrong. And I swear I did my best that day. I tried so hard to pull away. Nobody wants to hear you when you're down. It's relentless how the river rolls. Said he was late, not showing that lonesome wind crept up again. I'd pray for it to stop, and it began. And the rain came down like a hurricane. In my head was just the same. I remembered all the nights I spent alone. And I found cold comfort in how the river rolls. Ooh, grindstone girls do it best said soon. She said it like I already knew. Yes, I said, you know I've loved a few. And then she grabs me by my hand, leads me through that cool white sand, and we stare for a while at the moon. So damn beautiful, how the river rolls. So damn beautiful, how the river rolls.
That's fantastic. That's great. Thank you so much.
Thanks, man. My pleasure. My pleasure.
JNash.com is the place to find all sorts of information.
Yes.
And you, all the music I think we've talked about, and even more, available at iTunes.
Correct.
The latest CD is Diamonds and Blood. Mm-hmm. Jay, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
Singer-songwriter Jay Nash spoke with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums earlier this fall. Jay Nash grew up in upstate New York, lived for a while in L.A., and now lives in Vermont. He also suggested we ask you this question to give you a chance to win a copy of his album, The Things You Think You Need. The question is, what is the University of Vermont's mascot? Is it A, the Terrapin, B, the Wampus Cat, or C, the Catamount? You can call up with your answers at 1-800-522-5823. That's 1-800-522-KUAF. Your time starts now.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 21st of November, 2011. It's the birthday of Sir Arthur Quiller Couch, born in Cornwall, 1863. Published fiction, literary criticism, put out an anthology of English verse that was very popular, and is remembered today for his advice to writers. He said, "Whenever you feel an impulse to perpetrate a piece of exceptionally fine writing, obey it wholeheartedly and delete it before sending your manuscript to press. Murder your darlings." Murder your darlings. In other words, to avoid being too precious about your writing and to trust in simplicity and efficiency. It's the birthday of Voltaire, born Paris, 1694, the satirist who came under the influence of freethinkers in his youth and was imprisoned for his writing or sent into exile numerous times. Died a hero in 1778, best known to us for his novel Candide. Voltaire, who said, "If God did not exist, man would have to invent him." He said, "As long as people believe in absurdities, they will continue to commit atrocities." It's the birthday of Isaac Bashevis, singer born in Poland, 1904, came from a family of rabbis, grew up in the Jewish quarter of Warsaw, broke away from his Orthodox upbringing, emigrated to this country in 1935, wrote short stories, dozens of collections of them, and novels, memoirs, many children's books, almost exclusively in Yiddish. And he did it on a Yiddish typewriter that was no longer manufactured, and so there were no spare parts. And it's the birthday of the writer and director Harold Ramis, born in Chicago, 1944, co-wrote a great number of comedies, including National Lampoon's Animal House, Caddyshack, Stripes, Ghostbusters, Groundhog Day, and Analyze This. Here's a poem for today by Mary Mackey, entitled Turkeys. One November, a week before Thanksgiving, the Ohio River froze, and my great uncles put on their coats and drove the turkeys across the ice to Rosiclare, where they sold them for enough to buy my grandmother a Christmas doll with blue china eyes. I like to think of the sound of 200 turkey feet running across to Illinois on their way to the platter, the scrape of their nails and my great uncles in their homespun leggings calling out gee and haw and git to them as if they were mules. I like to think of the Ohio at that moment, the clear, cold sky, the green river sleeping under the ice, before the land got stripped and the farm got sold and the water turned the color of whiskey and all the uncles lay down and never got up again. I like to think of the world before some genius invented turkeys with pop-up plastic thermometers in their breasts, idiot birds with no wildness left in them, turkeys that couldn't run the river to save their souls. Turkeys by Mary Mackey, from Breaking the Fever, published by Marsh Hawk Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by Novo Nordisk since 1923, committed to diabetes care and areas of unmet medical needs at novonordisk-us.com. And by CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight, nearly 500 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce fuel consumption. CSX, How Tomorrow Moves. Produced by Kathy Roach and written by Heather McPherson. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
So today's question was inspired by Vermont, since that's where singer-songwriter Jay Nash is currently based. He asked, what is the University of Vermont's mascot? Is it A, the terrapin, B, the wampus cat, or C, the catamount? And the correct answer is...
the catamount. A catamount is it's like a type of mountain lion. It's a species of mountain lion that's... specific to the Green Mountains of Vermont.
A little bit of trivia from singer-songwriter Jay Nash. Our listeners who gave us the correct answer today, your names will be put into the ceramic cow and we will inform our winner how they can pick up a copy of the CD, The Things You Think You Need by Jay Nash from our radio station. Thank you for participating. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Springdale, Rogers, Bentonville, Tauntytown. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Ithi Agnihotri Mudholkar. Tomorrow, Kyle Kellums and Antoinette Grajeda will be back with another brand new edition of Ozarks at Large. Thanks for listening and have a great week.